16. The farther one goes from the center of Gibraltar town, the less English the landscape becomes. Driving south toward Europa Point in their rented red Honda, Gideon and Julie watched as the buildings, modest single-story homes mostly, became more and more Spanish, with red tile roofs predominating and pastel-colored stucco walls replacing stone ones. Even the rock itself, along the diminishing flank of which Europa Road took them, became rockier, drier, more austere, putting one more in mind of the stony windmill country of Man of La Mancha than of William Blake's green and pleasant England. After a mile and a half or so, the rock petered out altogether, plunging into the sea at Europa Point, the very tip of the peninsula. This was not quite the southernmost point of Europe. Punta de Tarifa, a few miles to the east in Spain, had that honor, being 1/10 of a degree of latitude lower. But it was supposedly the closest point in Europe to the coast of Africa, also by 1/10 of a degree, and it was, as Adrian had volunteered on the plane, the historic point at which General Tariq and his invading Moors had first set foot on the continent 1,300 years before. This information was provided by one of the line of informational posters set up on easels at the cleared, windswept cliffside site that was to become the Ivan S. Gunderson Visitor Center. Prue, on reading it, tilted her head to gesture behind her and said, "Looks to me like they've returned." She was referring to the blindingly white Ibrahim al-Ibrahim Mosque, the gleaming new dome and slender minaret of which dominated the area, dwarfing the red and white lighthouse that had stood for almost 200 years, serving as a sentinel over the narrow neck of water that separated the tranquil Mediterranean from the roiling Atlantic. Other than the lighthouse and the mosque, there wasn't much on this craggy, blustery plateau that swaddled the tail of the rock. Down near the water, of course, was the famous rock shelter itself, the Europa Point Cave, still mostly buried under the landslide that had killed Sheila Chan. But up here there was little to see. A parking area, some low, winding stone walls, a few trails, a historical marker, a few nondescript outbuildings, and a lot of desolate, rocky land swathed here and there with scraggly ground cover. A bus had come with a load of Asian tourists who wandered disconsolately around, obviously wondering why this desolate spot was on their tour, and politely trying to look interested as their guide pointed out Africa across the water and chattered away. The group of archaeologists and anthropologists that stood at the clifftop side of the dedication wasn't much larger, perhaps 30 in all, and certainly no more animated. They had dutifully wandered the line of posters, looking at historical notes, architects' renderings, and photos and paintings of Gibraltar Boy and his human mother. They had solemnly watched as the Governor-General turned over a gold-plated shovelful of earth, as the Freedom of the City Award, Gibraltar's highest honor, was posthumously bestowed on Ivan, accepted in his place by Rowley, and as a bronze plaque with Ivan's profile in bas-relief was unveiled by the Deputy Minister of Culture, to be installed later in the entrance rotunda of the center. And they had stood, shifting from foot to foot, listening to the inevitable speeches. The Governor General made one, the Minister of Culture made one, Rowley made one, and the President of the Historical Association made one, all extolling the manifold virtues of Ivan Samuel Gunderson. Adrian made one too, of course, and of course it was the longest of them all. Once he delivered the obligatory eulogy, he lapsed into one of his mellifluous, erudite lectures, going on and on and on about ecological conditions at Europa Point in the Pleistocene's waning years, forgetting, or more likely ignoring, the fact that almost everybody in his audience knew as much about it as he did. "Inasmuch as the northern ice sheets had not yet melted, the sea levels would have been far lower at that time. Thus our cave dwellers would have looked out, not on the water we see today, but on a marshy seaside plain harboring a rich array of game, rabbits, birds, foxes, fish, shellfish, tortoises, all would have been there within easy reach for the taking. Up here on the coastal plateau, there would have been horses and deer, and higher up on the rock, they would have found ibex. Taken all together, our first family and their clan surely lived what would have passed for a life of ease and—" Gideon's attention wandered. He peered down the face of the cliff, trying to pinpoint the location of the rock shelter, but couldn't find it. The particular part of the cliff face they overlooked was not a clean, vertical wall of rock plunging straight down to the sea, in which a cave would have been easy to spot, but a wide, deeply eroded gorge that had been more or less dammed up with mounded earthen detritus that ran all the way down to the water in a sloping incline. Clearly, the cave-in 4 years ago had been only the latest, and probably not the last, of the Europa Point land disturbances. "Prue, what do you say?" he murmured. "Could you show me around the site a little?"
"You mean right now, this minute?" she asked. "Please," she inclined her head toward Adrian,
who showed no sign of approaching his clothes, and cathedraled her fingers in front of her chest.
"Say yes."
"Yes," Gideon said, smiling. "Adrian's not going to notice."
"That's for sure. Julie, you want to come too?" "What? No, I think I'll give it a skip. Actually, I find what he's saying pretty interesting."
"That's because you're the only one here who hasn't heard it before." Corbin, protected from the sun by a floppy, broad-brimmed hat that was tied under his chin, was standing nearby. She tapped him on the shoulder.
"Hey, Corb, I'm going to show Gideon around the site down there. Want to come?"
He turned.
"What is there to see? It's not there anymore."
"Well, you know, just give him some idea of where stuff was, that kind of thing. Come on, you were the assistant director. You should be the one to give the tour."
Corbin's lips pursed.
"What I was the chief deputy director."
"Whatever. Come on already. You've heard this crap from Adrian a million times."
"Adrian is a very great archaeologist," Corbin said reprovingly. "He's always worth listening to."
"Yeah, yeah," said Prue. "Come on, chief deputy director. Let's get a move on."
Corbin glanced with something like amused resignation at Gideon. "What can you do with a woman like this?" And said,
"Very well."
They put upon but amicable sigh and led the way. Julie touched Gideon's arm as he followed.
"Be careful," she whispered. "Watch your step. Pay attention when you're climbing around. Don't stargaze."
"How can I? No stars."
"You know what I mean."
"Yes, I know what you mean. Don't worry, I'll be careful. I promise not to fall off."
"Now, where have I heard that before?"
With the path to the cave blocked by debris from the most recent landslide, getting to it required slipping under a danger do not cross ribbon, clambering over some broken stone walls, and negotiating the rough earthen fill, most of which was covered with a slippery, uneven mat of ground cover. Prue, in jeans and wearing cowboy boots with heels that dug in, managed it easily. But Gideon, in Rockport joggers, and Corbin, wearing brown oxfords, had to slip-slide their way down to the relatively level, ledge-like area that was almost at the bottom. Once there, Gideon could see the cave, which had been invisible from above, a cavern perhaps 50 feet wide, and in the parts that hadn't been obstructed by the recent landslide, about 20 feet deep.
"So, this is it,"
he said with the near mystical pleasure he always felt at times like this.
"Here, where I stand right now, on this rocky ledge, on this very spot, Neanderthal creatures, almost but not quite humans, once worked and played and went about their lives."
On the cave ceiling toward the rear, he could make out the sooty smudges from their fires, still plainly visible after 24,000 years.
"What's left of it?" Corbin said. "Well, let me give you the two-bit tour."
He walked them up and down the ledge, explaining the excavation strategies they'd resorted to. Rock shelters were trickier than ordinary digs on open land. What kind of grid system they'd used, where they'd found various materials, a fire pot over here, a couple of Mousterian tools over there.
Where was the first family burial?
Gideon asked. Corbin, dyed-in-the-wool archaeologist that he was deep in his analysis of the stone tool technology, and it looked as if he might be a while before he got around to the human remains.
Unfortunately, you can't see it anymore, said Prue. It was in a crevice about a foot off the floor of the cave, over there, under all that mess.
She pointed at an area to the right, where the overhang had come down altogether, so that it was no longer a rock shelter at all.
We lost about half the cave in the landslide, Corbin said. There was another 15 meters of it right there, but that's where the worst of it hit. Unfortunately, it was where most of the important finds were made. What a shame to see it covered over like that. Such an important site.
Well, I gather they're planning to dig it out again for visitors, Prue said.
Good luck, Gideon murmured, looking at the mass of earth in front of him. That's a lot of dirt.
It was as if one of those monstrous, three-story-tall, earth-moving machines had been excavating some vast crater somewhere up above, and had dumped its huge bucket down here time after time, with the express purpose of burying the rock shelter. The enormous pile of soil, now pocked with struggling vegetation, completely plugged up any access to this part of the cave.
What are those, do you know? He asked,
pointing at an unlikely row of a half-dozen evenly spaced holes dug into the base of the pile. Five were deep but relatively small, about 4 feet in diameter. The fifth, the last one in the row, was big, a good 10 feet in diameter and 10 feet deep. All had been made some time ago, their margins no longer sharp-edged, and all had been dug with tools, not naturally formed. The piles of backfill lay all around them. Before the question was out of his mouth, he realized what they were.
Is this where they dug Sheila Chan out?
Prue responded with a somber nod.
Yes. Interestingly, said Corbin, they do it the way we might do test trenching. The smaller holes, those were a uniformly spaced series of exploratory probes. The deep one?
Is where they found her, Gideon said.
Yes, Prue said again. I was here. Well, not down here, but up above. With some of the others. I stayed the whole dreary, cold, rainy, miserable day. You were there most of the time, too, weren't you, Corb?
I was. I felt as if it was my responsibility, as if I owed it to her somehow. I suppose I hoped in some obscure way that by being here, by simply assuming they would find her, that somehow...
He finished with a shrug. You understand, Gideon, Prue said. At that point we thought, we hoped, she might still be alive.
Ah, said Gideon.
He had gone up to the largest hole and was fingering its weathered margins. He picked up a chunk of backfill from it and broke it easily apart with his hands. A mixture of clay-like earth with a little humus and some gravelly rock fragments mixed in. Pretty ordinary soil, in other words. But something about it had started the gears of his mind turning. Something gnawed at him, just out of reach.
But of course she wasn't, Corbin said gravely. She was buried so very deeply. In fact, they were about to go on to dig the next probe when someone spotted her outstretched fingertips, just coming through the dirt, way down in the hole.
Me, Prue said. I spotted her.
How deep in the hole? Gideon asked.
Why he wanted to know, he wasn't sure, but there was something...
something.
Pretty deep, Prue said. And even then it was only her fingers we could see. The rest of her was much deeper, probably 8 or 10 feet down. So, of course, there was no chance. Gideon rubbed his palms together to get the dirt off them. A gritty residue remained.
Do you happen to know what the cause of death was?
Prue looked strangely at him.
Offhand, I'd say that having had 100 tons of dirt come down on her might have had something to do with it.
No, I mean the actual cause of death, the immediate cause. Asphyxiation, brain injury, crushing chest injuries.
I have no idea. Why is it important?
Just wondering, he said vaguely. It was the best he could come up with.
Back at the top, Adrian, the final speaker, had finished up and the ceremony was winding down. Prue went to join Audrey and Buck, who were climbing into Rolly's van for the ride back. Corbin, who was driving Adrian, waited politely while his mentor accepted compliments and answered questions from a few hangers-on. Julie was waiting for Gideon, sitting on one of the rough stone walls at the edge of the cliffs, looking out over the glittering strait. "The mountains that rise before us," she intoned, "are part of the chain known as Air Rif, geologically speaking a component of the Great Cordillera, that once stretched southward from the Iberian Peninsula into what is now Africa, which was not separated from the European continent by the Strait of Gibraltar until the Tertiary."
"Good gosh," Gideon said. "You keep listening to Adrian, and maybe you can start giving me some competition at Trivial Pursuit."
"Nobody can give you competition at Trivial Pursuit. Gideon, you got a call from Fausto on the cell phone. The lab said the wires and the lamp cord were definitely filed, not just worn down."
He sat down beside her. "So somebody really did try to kill me."
"Are you surprised?"
"No, but I can't help being astonished."
"The difference being?"
"There's an old story, supposedly about Noah Webster, the dictionary guy, in which Webster's wife catches him in some hanky-panky with the maid. 'Mr. Webster, I am surprised,' she says. 'No, my dear,' says Webster. 'I am surprised. You are astonished.' However, I've also seen it attributed to Samuel Johnson, and even Winston Churchill, so the provenance is dubious, to say the least."
"See," she said, laughing, "you're in no danger of losing your Trivial Pursuit title belt." She turned serious. "But I know what you mean. Maybe it doesn't surprise you, but you still find it hard to believe."
"Exactly."
"Yes, me too." She reflected for a moment and stood up with a sigh. "Anyway, Fausto wants you to come in and get fingerprinted so they can start working out whose prints are on the lamp. I told him I'd drop you off at the police station on the way back to the hotel."
"Do you know where the police station is?"
"I saw it yesterday while I was wandering around on my own. A great old red brick building with Gothic arches, very Victorian. Easy to imagine Inspector Lestrade coming out of it on his way to meet with Sherlock Holmes."
She waited a few seconds for him to get up as well, but he was lost in his thoughts, frowning, staring at nothing.
"Gideon, are you there? Shall we go?"
He finally stood up. "Definitely. I wanted to talk to Fausto, too. There's something funny about that landslide."
"What?"
"I don't know." He shook his head slowly back and forth. "But something."